Today, how then shall we live?
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
I'm sure you recognize the title from Francis Schaeffer. A lot of people have pursued that avenue. I'm not going down that road exactly, but it is the same question that we have to ask, and about that same topic: how, as believers, are we supposed to live in a world that's not full of believers? And we're dealing more and more with that reality. I mean, it's always been the reality, but we're dealing more and more with that reality as we observe the changes in our culture right now. And again, I don't think there's that much change in the truth of that condition, that we've lived in a world that's not primarily of believers. But our recognition of it is at least coming to bear on us now more than ever before. So, you know, when I was in junior high and high school, I debated. This was my background. I've mentioned this before. And as I look back on it, you know, what I thought it was teaching me at the time, obviously, was just how to win an argument, how to win outright, how to destroy the opponent, you know. So as a junior high or high schooler, I've mentioned, you know, we my debate partner and I were good enough, and we certainly thought we were good enough, but I mean, our win record said we were good. We had a goal of just annihilating the other side. We didn't want to win. We wanted them to cry. You know, that's how. But this was in junior high and high school. I've certainly gotten past that. And you also learn in that context that you're not really, you're not beating the other side doesn't mean they feel defeated. It means the judge believes you and is convinced by what you have said. And so it's speaking to the audience, not to the opponent. So all of that kind of stuff is what I thought I was learning when I was in debate. And all of that stuff has helped me. I mean, in the sense of being able to communicate ideas, and you may not think I learned anything about that, but you should see it before I was a debater. Anyway, all of those things have been important, and they've helped me. They've helped me tremendously. A lot of people, I mean, when I was going through my English degree, when I was working on my MDiv here at Criswell College, when I was finishing my PhD, writing my dissertation, all of those sort of skills in rhetoric and also argumentation and how to handle large amounts of evidence and draw a conclusion, all those things were really important to me. They did help me. I am grateful for those. But what I've realized now I was really learning in debate is quite the opposite. And it showed up for me in the weirdest way back when I was still in college. I had just gotten out of high school. And I had stayed over I went to a friend's house early one morning to pick him up, and we were just going to go hang out that day, do something. And his dad came out, had not gone off to work yet. And his dad was a little shady. I mean, not a little shady, a lot shady. I mean, he had some shady businesses and business practices, and he was just sort of I don't know the right word for it, but not close to a con man. I mean, just really lacked integrity in the business world. Super nice guy. You can imagine that made it worse because he could convince people to trust him. But this is my friend's dad, not my friend. And so my friend's dad came out, and he was talking, and he's super nice, so I'm just having a conversation with him. And I was telling him about debate and, you know, how I was involved in debate and whatever. And he said, you know what I don't like about debate, never have, is that it teaches people to see both sides of an issue. So they never learn to really make a decision. And I was thinking to myself, that seems like a weird thing to complain about. I mean, I get that people need to be able to make a decision. That's a really critically important part of leadership in life. But it's also critically important that you be able to understand things from more than one perspective. Unless you somehow think you're omniscient, it could help to gain someone else's perspective. And I did, even in that moment, even just as a college student, think to myself, you know, I'm kind of glad I'm able to step into other people's shoes and see where they'd be coming from. Because in debate, you don't get to pick whether you're affirmative or negative most of the time. You just, you get a topic, and you know, the topic is you're in favor of healthcare reform, or you're in favor of whatever. That's the topic or the subject, the issue, the resolution, as it's called. But then whether you're defending it or attacking it is assigned to you. Sometimes you're negative, sometimes you're affirmative. And so very often you're arguing against the very plan you would advocate for if you were on the other side. So you really do have to learn where the strengths and weaknesses are in your own arguments and also in others' arguments, which most prominently means you have to learn to see the weaknesses in your own arguments. And I had to learn to see the weaknesses in my own arguments, but also to see where the strengths were in others' arguments. It didn't necessarily mean I agreed with them, and I very rarely did. I was a fairly opinionated person. But it did mean I could appreciate the value behind their argument and not attack straw men or these, you know, weak imitations of their argument, but actually go to the point that was most important. That becomes important for the conversation we're going to have today for reasons that are different than I've talked about it before, that have more to do with the way we have to live in a world where there are always going to be people who are disagreeing with us. And this came to me in terms of a bit of vocabulary, a term that I haven't used a lot lately. And it emerged for me again because I listen to audiobooks all the time. Different people have different learning styles. Some people look down or they frown on this, you know, you're not reading enough books on paper. Well, you know, I mean, when I'm riding a bike, I listen to my audiobook. When I'm driving 3 hours to go speak somewhere or preach somewhere on a Sunday morning, I listen to an audiobook on the way there and on the way back. And it's fantastic. So I get all these books downed in that way. And that's how I learn. It's different from how other people learn. But it's how I learn. If I hear something, then I've learned it. And I synthesize it while I'm listening to it. So it becomes embedded in me, which is risky because I very often forget where I got it. But I do give credit. I got, well, yeah, I read somewhere. You know, that's where a lot of this comes to me on audiobooks. But I am an audio learner and listener. This is just how I am. Even when I'm reading a book, by the way, this is by way of confession, even when I'm reading a book on paper, you know, so I'm turning pages, which is not my favorite way. I read digitally most of the time. But if I'm in a book and turning pages, I find myself, you know, reading with subliminal pronunciations. So I'm pronouncing the words in my head. I'm speaking them audibly. So yes, I am a catatonically slow reader. And it's, you know, it just takes me a lot longer than it takes other people to read things. Now I'm not saying that embarrassingly. It can seem embarrassing when everybody else is ready to turn the page and you're like, oh, just give me like 5 more minutes, y'all, and I'll be ready to move to the next slide. But I do know it once I'm finished with it. I mean, that's just how I learn. We learn differently. So anyway, I'm listening to this audiobook on Eisenhower right now, Eisenhower and War and Peace, by, I don't know if it's John Edward Smith, how you pronounce his name. But it's really good, very insightful. It was written a few years ago, back in the Obama administration, I think. Anyway, it covers Eisenhower, you know, his life, his presidency, and the time that he led during World War II, especially. So Eisenhower in War and Peace. And while I'm listening to this, I'm also listening to the things that he was playing a key role in bringing to pass. So in Germany, you know, subdividing Germany into English, American, French, and Soviet sectors, which the big three did at Yalta and Potsdam. And you know all those stories back in 1945, what was going on. If you don't, you know, go read a book and explore it. It's fascinating how it took place. But Eisenhower was behind a lot of that, and bringing it to pass was really his work, which I find interesting. At the same time, while he was both observing and participating in that way of deciding how Germany was going to move forward in this world of nations that were going to work together, and how the United States was going to cooperate with an ally that was communist when the United States was in this prime position of opposing communism in the 1940s. And so, you know, how the Americans and Soviets would get along and where England's going to fit into that and where the formerly defeated and now just recovering France and De Gaulle are going to fit into that. It's all, you know, part of the picture of what shapes Eisenhower and the way he thinks about things. Again, this is just coming from that book. And in that moment, I was thinking to myself, you know, this is shaping him because, this is just in the back of my head, I'm thinking, because eventually you have to realize you need a modus vivendi, this Latin term for a method of continuing your life with people you don't necessarily agree with. It's a term. I mean, it's a term that just means way of living, but it's a term that's been used historically in Christianity to describe how believers think about living among those who are not in agreement with them. How do you live in an empire that's anti-Christian when you're a Christian? Much of the New Testament is written about that. But then how do you live in a world where even if the emperor is a Christian, not everyone else has faith in their own life, you know, that they're living out? How do you live in a world where you're governed by, Muslims, for instance? How does a Christian live in that world? That would be a modus vivendi. So I was saying, this is kind of weird because what he's doing is he's figuring out a modus vivendi. And then the word comes into the book a few chapters later when you're dealing with how Korea became divided between North and South Korea under the Eisenhower administration right at the end of the Truman era because he didn't want to maintain the war that was going on in the French colonial struggle to keep power in Vietnam or to recover power. In Vietnam, I'm jumped to Vietnam. That's the next one. We'll talk about that one in a second. But in Korea, when they were having this major conflict right at the beginning of the 1950s, Eisenhower was unwilling to continue it and said, you know, what we need here is a modus vivendi. We need a way that we can recognize that the Koreans don't have to overrun the peninsula, that we don't have to win back the northern part of the peninsula, but instead at this 38th parallel where we've approximately run into this loggerheads and are not finding a solution where we can just tolerate each other. Now, you can agree or disagree that that was a good solution, and I know what it's leading to right now and all the, persistent problems that come from it. I'm not concerned about whether it was a good answer or a bad answer, but he had been shaped in this idea that you could segment a country between these parties who needed to coexist and figure out how they could coexist as a modus vivendi. So Korea was an example of that in the 38th parallel. In the same way, as I started to mention a moment ago when I slipped forward in my notes by accident, Vietnam, comes that way in the Eisenhower administration because he doesn't engage in the war in Vietnam. Remember, that comes under Kennedy later. Eisenhower is obsessed with maintaining peace because, like Grant, he'd been through war and he didn't want to replicate the errors of the war. He saw the terrors of war. And so he ends up dividing the country at the 17th parallel. I mean, it's his guidance that brings it to pass with the Viet Minh to the north, the communist Viet Minh to the north, and the French Vietnamese and the Vietnamese state to the south. And Eisenhower's reasoning about it is really simple, that there are only really two options for what's going to happen in the conflict. Either the French are going to win outright, but that would require tremendous losses. I mean, a much steeper commitment of not only French lives, but American lives and British lives and others who would have to compete in the warfare as well or participate in the warfare as well. And so there's that. The French win at this tremendous cost. Or the communists win outright. We just back out, and they win outright. And then the domino effect, as we referred to it back then, and I don't even know whether that was true or not. And again, I'm not saying this is good policy or bad policy, but I am saying it's where this term came up for me again, the modus vivendi. And this was the option that Eisenhower put down instead. He said, no, instead of either of those two unacceptable options, what we should do is find a way that these people can coexist without constant warfare. And so we'll create a dividing line, and we will observe this standard, this treaty, around this dividing line, and that will be our way of living, our modus vivendi, how we're going to get along. And so I as I'm hearing all this and thinking about it, I'm thinking, we are constantly having to deal with what modus vivendi has meant for us as believers for so long. We have constantly had to deal with the reality that we live in a world where people disagree with us, and we have to decide how we're going to reconcile that, how we're going to live in that world, what our method of living is going to be. And so that's what I want to address. What is our modus vivendi in this world? What is our responsibility, and what's our method for living out our Christianity in a way that's consonant with Scripture, but recognizing the reality of this world that may or may not care about the things that Scripture says? And so there's, you know, there's a really, by the way, there's a really shallow way that we deal with this. And I don't mean shallow as insulting to everybody who holds it. I just mean all of us kind of go through this way of thinking about it. And I'm throwing myself in the lump here. We all do this, in which we say, and we trivialize it to this phrase, well, you know, so in this world where there are so many sinners and our job is to represent the good news, it is, we will say, well, it's my responsibility to love sinners, but I don't have to love their sin. So I love the sinner and I hate the sin. You know, that's what we say. And so I can hold my ground and, you know, be steep in my pronouncement of judgment and so on. Now, if you really want to hear a conversation or participate in a conversation about that question, you know, how are we supposed to relate to sinners? Do we judge the sin? Are we not supposed to judge the sin? I'm going to speak about it very briefly here, but I'm just going to fly through it. But if you want to go and hear a real conversation about it, it's in episode 21. So at barrycreamer.com, you can find our previous episodes. You know, however you're downloading your podcast, if you go back and look up the episode that's called Meek and Wild, about what Jesus actually does in his practice of judging people or giving grace or forgiveness to people, hence the name Meek and Wild. When is he throwing tables and when is he extending grace? Then I would encourage you to go back and listen to that episode. But the idea that we love the sinner and hate the sin, you know, ultimately for anybody who, and all of us sort of realize this pretty quickly, it's not sustainable in terms of how we read Scripture. That idea isn't something we can always defend. Because in Scripture, sinners are judged. And I'm not even saying ontologically, although I believe it. I believe it's absolutely true that this is what happens. But in Scripture, it's clear, the way the Bible is written, sins are not judged, sinners are judged. Sinners are judged because of their sins. Deceit, for instance, is not cast into the lake of fire. Deceivers are cast into the lake of fire. And so the idea of segregating judgment of people from judgment of actions, you know, doesn't quite work that way. And all of us, you know, we'd like to be able to do that. We'd like to be able to objectify the content of our arguments and separate it from the people. But, you know, if you say to a person, your idea is dumb, it doesn't take a lot of thinking for that person to conclude that you think they're not very bright. Because if their idea is dumb and it's being housed in their mind, you know, it's really... So I get it. I say it all the time. Look, I'm not criticizing you. I'm criticizing your argument. But if a person's really holding that argument, it's very difficult to say, this is how I extracted the argument from your soul and separated it from my opinion about you. It's really hard to justify that. And biblically, it's impossible. Because in Scripture, I mean, the sinners do end up being judged. And not even at the end of time. I mean, even on the way, sinners end up being judged very often. So it's biblically unsustainable. It's also, though, empirically unsustainable. Christians throughout history have had no qualms whatsoever about judging sinners. And believe me, sinners have noticed. Their critique of the Crusades is their recognition that Christianity en masse has had no problem slaughtering sinners in the process of history. I understand that there's more complexity to that story than just one side, but our side is the side I'm looking at right now, and I'm a Christian. And we have not separated the sinners from their sin. In the same way, the Spanish conquistadors and the priests who traveled with them, the way that they dealt with Native American populations in the Southwest, I mean, they had a, and so look, I'm not sweepingly condemning every single person. I don't know what every single person did, but I know what happened in the Southwest, and I know what happened in those communities of Native Americans that were in the Southwest. There was a convert or die expansion strategy for the kingdom of God. Join the kingdom of God, or we'll slaughter your people. And so they became Catholic or they became dead. And I'm not saying that happened in every village, but it happened in a tremendous number, enough that it is often referred to as a genocide, and justifiably so. You know, and by the way, as a side note, there is another confusion that sort of goes with this. And this is a side note altogether, but on the way, I've got to mention this, and then I need to do a whole episode on this. We confuse things sometimes. So like when I bring up the Native Americans, people will respond to me by saying, yeah, well, did you know what they were doing? I mean, these people were going and slaughtering each other, and they were practicing cannibalism, and they were doing terrible things. So this is a confusion that we have. And it is thinking that an injustice that's been perpetrated is somehow made less important by the unrelated injustices of its victims. It doesn't matter how bad another person is if I'm the one committing an injustice. I'm still being unjust to them. And no matter what they've done, I don't have the ability to sweep under the rug the evil that I'm perpetrating. And so let's not confuse the issue by saying, yeah, but sinners, you know, they've really done all of these terrible things. Maybe so. And my statement that the conquistadors were committing injustices in their way of sweeping through the American Southwest, what we now refer to as the American Southwest, that when I say that I'm not valorizing Native Americans. There were valorous Native Americans and there were villainous Native Americans, just like there are that among all peoples. So you have to separate that out. Okay, so anyway, there's this trifling matter, manner of how we deal with judgment, of just saying, oh, but I'm not judging sinners. I'm not condemning people. I'm just talking about their sins. But we know we can't really maintain that distinction, either biblically or empirically, because we haven't ever done that. But there is also this important distinction to make, to recognize that there is a judgment. That I'm not saying on the basis of this, oh, well, the way everybody lives is just fine. That's not true. There are all kinds of injustices in the world, and they're horrible. And I've talked about them on many times. I mean, I'm an advocate for the sanctity of human life because I recognize the value of, I want all of us to recognize, and I try with everything in me to make sure that I recognize the value of every human life. And I'm including those of, like, my little grandbaby right now who's growing up in a womb, and I've already seen their feet raised up to their head, you know, and it's like, yeah, well, you're going to be curled into a little ball if you don't stop doing that. You know, that's how they look. I'm looking at that baby, my grandbaby, and I care about that life. Injustice to me is discounting that life and acting as if it should not be protected. I'm happy to talk about any of that stuff. I'm not pretending there's not a reason for judgment to come into the world. I know that there is. I know that there's been enough evil in the world that somebody's got to do something about it at some point. The thing is that somebody is God, you know, not me. God judges people. And biblically, and certainly for believers, we're told this. Now, I'm not saying that God can't parse out to others the responsibility to judge, as he does and talks about in the book of Romans. It's clear. That's fine. But to believers, he makes it clear. He says to us, not only does God judge people, only God judges people. Like in James, you know, one of the earlier books in the New Testament, earlier written books in the New Testament, in the early forms of Christianity, James is telling the believers not to judge one another. He starts out speaking about it as among themselves because they have all these conflicts within their own midst. And so he says, do not speak evil against one another, brothers. This is in the fourth chapter of James. The one who speaks against a brother or judges his brother. Now, I'm not going down this road again. Again, we can talk about this later, or you can go listen to it in Meek and Wild. I just want you to hear the end statement that he makes here, though. The one who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks evil against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you're not doing what the law said, which was to extend mercy, by the way. You're not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is only one lawgiver and judge, he who is able to save and to destroy. Who are you to judge your, and this time he doesn't say brother, he appeals back to the Old Testament and says neighbor. And we get the idea. Oh, this is part of loving your neighbor. To say somehow I've converted judging my neighbor into loving my neighbor. Well, you know, it's not loving to let them get by with living this self-destructive lifestyle. And so we convert the word love to whatever we feel like doing to our neighbor, even judging them, when that's not what the word love means. And clearly here, James is saying to us, you know, loving your neighbor means not judging your neighbor. That's what the law declares as our responsibility. But listen to how he goes on. In James 5, after he brings, this is after the end of James 4, he gets to this little segment, and at the beginning of chapter 5, he talks about the wealthy among them who are abusing those who work for them, and they're keeping back their wages so they can earn the interest on it, or just so they don't have to pay them at all. You know, you never know when a laborer is not going to show up and get their check. They're cheating people. And so he condemns them, and he says, that's wicked, and you shouldn't be that way, and you're the kind of people who are building rusty buckets, and you're going to get to heaven and realize that none of the treasure you were supposed to have, you have, and so on. So he condemns them outright at the beginning of James 5, but then he says to the believers this: how should you respond to the injustice of those wealthy people who are holding back the money that rightfully belongs to you? Does he say, oh, teach them a lesson, tell them about economics, you straighten them out, those wicked people? Not at all. This is what he says to the believers who are being legitimately cheated by these wealthy people. He says to the believers, be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. Why until the coming of the Lord? Because he's the one who judges. Listen to what he says. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth? He uses the illustration, by the way, that comes directly from the injustice, because they've been working in fields where the wealthy landowners have not been paying them. And so they haven't gotten the produce they were looking for. And he says, but it's like that seed you planted. The seed hasn't come up either, but you'll get your fruit. God will take care of you. So he said, I mean, it's really a brilliant passage. Anyway, he says, I mean, not that any of them aren't brilliant, but I mean, you can see the brilliance in this one so clearly. See how the farmer waits, he says, for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until it receives the early and the late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, because the coming of the Lord is at hand. Don't grumble one against another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. As an example of suffering and patience, in other words, you're suffering, and I'm telling you to be patient. You want an example of that? Take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. He says to the believers, James, to this early group of believers, he says, be patient, tolerate the evil that's coming against you right now, because their judge is standing at the door. You don't have to, and your judge is standing at the door. And if you try to become the judge, then you're not doing what the judge said for you to do. You're doing the things the judge told you he would judge you for. So don't do that. Back up. So the important distinction is that we're not left with the prerogative of judging the sinners around us. What we're left with is loving the sinner, period. That's what we're given the responsibility for. And that's not a surprise, given the great commandment. That is the great commandment: love your neighbor and love the stranger as your neighbor. That's how it's given to us in Leviticus 19, and that's what Jesus refers to. Okay, so all of that said, how does this play out in the way we actually practice our Christianity in the world? And so I just want to give you a couple of examples and then draw a conclusion. So the first example that comes to mind for this would be immigration. And if you just think about it for a second, you'll realize that the options we have for thinking about how to resolve immigration or how immigration might come to a resolution on its own are similar. The options that we have are similar to the kinds of options that Eisenhower would have been talking about with Korea or with Vietnam. You know, they win, we win, or we find a modus vivendi. And that's what I'm presenting here, for instance, in this case, regarding immigration. So the options that we have here, let's consider a couple of them. There are different ways of thinking of this, but I think this is one reasonable way to characterize how some people would think of it. So number one, there is they win. And by that, I mean, let's call they the immigrants. The immigrants win. Now, this isn't really the immigrants winning, but in our current system and the conflicts that exist around it, it would be the immigrants coming in, being able to get in, so all having practically open borders. Maybe it's still illegal, but nobody's stopping them, you know, and it's a wink, wink, nod, nod kind of arrangement. And so they come in and they get the jobs that they want. They don't have to go through all the paperwork of becoming citizens and blah, blah, blah. So immigrants get to come in because we need them. You know, we need them for the work and so on like that. But they function as a different kind of member of society than those who were born here. In that world, that scenario, which really prevailed a lot over the last 30 or 40 years, maybe since the Reagan amnesty, maybe just before the Reagan amnesty, it was already that way in some ways, that approach is a way for some people to say, oh, well, let's just go back to that. Let's just let immigration work out that way, and that'll take care of all of our economic issues. But there are problems that come with that that are the reason that we've had to rethink immigration policy to begin with. I mean, it's a significant part of the reason. There are unexpected problems that come with it, too. So, for instance, human trafficking and abuses of people happen not because there are immigrants present, but because they are living in the shadows as a different kind of member of society. And so, for instance, victims are unwilling to call the police because they don't want to be deported. They don't want to lose their income. They don't want to, be sent home where they cannot earn the money that's supporting their family back home. And so human trafficking flourishes because of that, and abuses flourish because of that. And that's a lot of, by the way, that's a lot of the reason that these sanctuary cities have emerged. Whether that's good, bad, or indifferent, the motivation behind it is very often to avoid that, to say, you can call the police and we will do something to protect you. But so that's an unexpected problem that would come, or a problem that comes if you allow, if immigration is just going rampant, you know, just anybody comes in that wants to and they get to support the economy, but they live as immigrants. They don't become integrated into society thoroughly. Another problem that comes with it is, by the way, the criminality itself, because they have ready-made primary victims, people who can't call the police. And so you have all of these thefts taking place against other immigrants and abuses of other kinds that you can imagine. But also that when you're having to live in an already morally dark area, I drive but without insurance because I can't get a license because I don't have a work permit or whatever it is, then obviously you're going to have all kinds of problems. And so obviously we're going to say, man, that's not a good option. We don't want that. Just like Eisenhower was saying, and it's not a good option for us to have to spend all the lives that it would take to get back the territory in North Vietnam, for instance. The other option on immigration, the second option, we win. So some people would consider we win, meaning there are no more immigrants. So we have a nice, perfect, impermeable wall that keeps the immigrants out. We have deportations for the immigrants and refugees who are already here, and there's no one like that present at all. But that also brings unexpected problems, and not just from the legal immigrants. I don't have time to go all the way into this process, but illegal and legal immigrants reflect a part of this unexpected problem that comes up. For instance, I received an article. I get communications from this group on a regular basis called the American Business Immigration Coalition, ABIC. And they sent a link to an article. Now, ABIC is a nonpartisan immigrant reform organization. They want immigration reform organization. They work with Democrats. They work with Republicans just to get past the logjam that comes from the way immigration is used as a fodder for political causes. It's not really about resolving immigration problems. It's about stirring up your base on either side. So we're going to let everyone in, or we're going to keep all those people out. And that makes people on the, not just fringes, but on the periphery, on both sides, that makes them happy and it makes them involved. And so immigration is worth more as a political football than it is as something that's resolved and actually dealt with in our public policy, which is a shame, but that's kind of where we are right now. And so ABIC is trying to resolve that and say, well, let's get both sides together and actually produce something that's a better solution. And so this article that I got from the Wall Street Journal an article by Michelle Hackman from April 5th, 2022. It's called Add Declining Immigration to the Problems Weighing on the Labor Market. The point is that we can't find enough laborers to do a lot of the jobs that are involved, including in some of those industries that are affected most by the immigration shortfall that's happened over the last few years, not just because the policies of previous administrations, but also because of COVID. You know, the attempt that people have made to keep the disease out, regardless of what you think of those attempts, immigration has gone down dramatically, where normally you would have a million immigrants a year coming into the country and supplying a workforce in those industries where immigrants dominate. You haven't had that lately. It's turned to just a trickle over the last couple of years. And that's not the major problem in the labor market. It's just one source of a problem in the labor market. And that's just a recognition that there's a reason that immigrants feel drawn to the United States, not just that they want to live on a mansion on a lake. There's more to it than that. There's also the invitation of the economy for them to be entrepreneurial or create things or to have, you know, whatever. So, but whatever the motivation, they do end up serving the economy in some ways. And obviously, I'm primarily talking about just documented immigrants, people who come in legally and go through all the process. Even that has dried up over the last few years in a lot of ways, and so it's affecting us. My point is that if we try to pick a winner, we are also picking a really heavy cost. That's why there's a conflict over the issue. There's a cost associated with it. And so what we need is what ABIC is advocating for, by the way, a modus vivendi. I don't think they use those words or that term, but that's what we need, a way of living. How do we get along with people? And I don't mean just the immigrants. How do we get along with them? But I mean, how do the people who are advocating for immigration get along with the people who are advocating to build the wall and keep the immigrants out? You know, how do we find a policy that allows both sides to have a coexistence that makes sense without one having to defeat and vanquish and send away the other one? And the answer to this is fairly simple. I say this, the answer is simple. I don't mean the policy is simple. I don't mean the political answer is simple, but I mean, we all recognize what would really need to happen, and that is that we would have to decide that we're willing to treat immigrants, people on the other side of the border, as people, as persons, but as persons who are in our society with exactly the same privileges and responsibilities that other people in our society have. And getting it to that point, obviously, is not easy to figure out in terms of policy, but in terms of a basic goal and saying, you know, this is the parallel that divides us, so let's solve the parallel by saying they do have to follow exactly the same laws and they do have to participate in government exactly the same way. They have to pay their taxes. They have to do everything else. Then we've at least started to address a way for us to live together in the culture, in the society. Let me give one that's slightly more provocative, a little more challenging for us to think about, and that's in terms of transgender people. So, and I'm not addressing or trying to resolve the arguments that we could have for a long time, which I think are important arguments, about the nature of transgenderism. You know, does anything actually even change? And is there a fixed gender? Of course, I believe in two genders. I think that's how God created us. I think there's a very important reason for that in the way we exist and so on. I'm not trying to obfuscate the reality of where I stand as a person and as a Christian and as a believer, you know, who's following Christ. Those are things I believe in. But I also know in the society, there are people who practice transgenderism or whatever the appropriate term is for describing that, are transgender. And in that society, what are my choices? Looking at it in these options that we've been describing parallel to, you know, what happened in Korea and Vietnam. And, you know, one is, and I think a lot of people think this way, well, let's eliminate them. Let's make it illegal. Let's make it so that they, you know, they don't have a bathroom that they can use or, you know, whatever that they would be comfortable in and so on. And or paint them only as the enemy. So it's the sort of push them out. They don't belong in this society kind of approach. I understand the push to go that way. I understand the reasons for being concerned about the influence that people have on others. I get all of that. I'm just saying that's one option. We win. We eliminate those people. That's an option. Another option is that we recognize we can't win, and so we withdraw. So we give up on being part of a world that's willing to accept them. You know, so we just say, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to have our own society, and we're going to separate ourselves from them. And there's a secession, a withdrawal from society, a form of Christianity that's been batted around for a few years. And some people are sort of taking that approach. And some people take that approach unintentionally. But the idea, sadly, just gives up the public space to be a place where there are no Christians present, or at least none who represent a different view. And so those two options, you know, that's just like saying, well, my two options are the Americans win and take over North Vietnam. Really, it was the French at the time. Or the communists win and the dominoes begin to fall. But then the modus vivendi is the real option. And I would encourage us to pause and realize this, that we can't simply eliminate people, because even when we have an internally, I mean this in the emotional sense, even when we have an emotionally violent reaction to what they're doing, we don't have the prerogative of them simply ceasing to exist. So, you know, what can we do? And the answer in a modus vivendi approach would be to treat them like other human beings, which would mean empathize where there's pain and suffering, pray for their good, because that's what we're told to do, pray for their good, trust God to deal with whatever he thinks needs to be dealt with, including fixed or changed in that person. But we trust God to do that. Our unwillingness to tolerate others at all is starting to poke through the surface in our culture. Not just among believers, you know, among all of us. I mean, people are out to eliminate each other. You know, this shows up in sort of the inverse fashion of people who were saying over the last 20 years, well, if that guy wins the election, I'm moving to Canada. You know, I'm buying an island out in the Pacific to move to, you know. This is the opposite of that. This is that form that comes up and says, man, we're going to have an insurrection, or we're going to have some way to lock these people up because they can't be allowed to do what they're doing. Our unwillingness to tolerate others at all is starting to poke through the surface in our whole society, including among believers, unfortunately, but it's not just among believers. So when people are chanting, lock her up, about Clinton, or prosecutors are pursuing felony charges for anything they can find against Trump, then we've come to a point where we're saying we don't even want them to be free in our society. They disagree with us. We are not willing to tolerate them at all. Now, we know the basic rule here that we ought to be applying is treating others as being of equal worth, right, with us. And so I would put that in the form of these arguments that we have, these disagreements that we have. Arguments, I don't mean vociferous speaking back and forth, but I mean as we're presenting our ideas, they're presenting their ideas. If I can't see the weaknesses in my own arguments, then why would someone else believe me when I say I can see the weaknesses in their arguments? They just think I'm being one-sided. I don't even see the weaknesses in my own arguments. Why would they trust me to see the weaknesses in theirs? And if I can't see the strengths in their arguments, then why would someone believe me when I show them what I think are the strengths in mine? I'm not being fair. I'm not being rational about it. This is the problem when on, you know, one side we're talking about the entanglements of the Trump family in Russia, and then on the other side we're talking about the entanglements of the Biden family in China, but nobody who talks about the Biden entanglements talks about the Trump entanglements, and nobody who talks about the Trump entanglements talks about the Biden entanglements, and I'm not sure both shouldn't be talked about. My point is that we're not willing to treat each other with equal respect, so we have to start thinking about that. Look, our desire for others who are in our world, with whom we have to find a modus vivendi, we have to find a way of living, our desire for others, even adversaries to our faith, not just people outside of our faith, I mean opponents, adversaries to our faith. Our desire for others is to be blessed. And that desire for others to be blessed is an essential evidence of our faith. It's the measure of our faith. Peter talks about it. I'll read it as quickly as I can in 1 Peter 3. Well, not as quickly as I can. That would be a blur. But as quickly as I can with some form of articulation. So when Peter is telling believers how they're supposed to live in an environment where they are being persecuted, where they are suffering, he says, well, who is there to harm you if you're zealous for what's good? You just keep doing what's right. And you'll be okay. But then he says, but I know that's not really going to work out in the world. So he says, but even if you should suffer for the sake of right, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them. Don't be troubled. In your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. That's not a verse about apologetics. That's a verse about being able to say to someone who looks at you and says, why on earth would you continue believing in Jesus? Why would you continue to believe in Jesus when we've taken all your property and thrown you in jail? And that's when they're supposed to be able to answer and say, well, because I believe Christ is the ultimate judge. And I believe he's the one that I'm going to answer to. And so I trust him. And that's why we're able to have a good conscience. And he finishes all of this. And we do it even responding to those people. We do it with gentleness and respect. He says, because it's better for you to suffer for doing good, if that should be God's will, than for doing evil. All of that in 1 Peter 3. And then he begins chapter 4, talking about how Christ suffered, so we should expect to suffer, and non-believers live these debauched and excessive, extravagant lives, and even self-destructive lives, and lives that are destructive of others. And in response to that, he says, this is our responsibility. With respect to this, they are surprised when you do not join them in the same flood of debauchery, and they malign you, but they'll give account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. So they speak evil against you, but you won't speak evil against them. They are condemning you, and they are blaspheming. They're your adversary, but you just refuse to be their adversary because you know they will give an account to him who's ready to judge the living and the dead. It's in that context that Jeremiah is saying in the Old Testament in the same way to the Israelites, to the Jews who were living in captivity. Hey, you're going to be there for a long time. So what are you supposed to do? Seek the welfare of the city where I've sent you into exile and pray to the Lord on that city's behalf. For in its welfare, you'll find your welfare. You know that verse, Jeremiah 29:7. Everybody's been quoting it lately because it's right. We need to recognize that that's our responsibility as believers in this world. So how do we respond to the evil around us without defending ourselves, without the need to defeat everyone else? By believing God can manage his own judgment in his own time, and that the only reason he hasn't done it already is his desire instead to distribute grace. May we have more of his grace, and may we trust more in him for the judgment.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.